Hello and welcome to the Indiana Lawyer Podcast, your source for news and Hoosier law, brought to you by Taft. I'm Alexa Schrake, Indiana Lawyer Reporter, and your host this week. As always, I'm here in our Monument Circle studio with Daniel Carson to give you the rundown on the latest legal news. Plus, I chat with Southern District Court Senior Judge Sarah Evans Barker to kick off Women's History Month. So, let's get started. Today is Wednesday, March 6, 2024, and these are your headlines. Daniel, why don't you start us off with some news from the Indiana Supreme Court?
The Indiana Supreme Court rejected Vannon Healthcare Global's petition to transfer after the company asked the High Court to hear an appeal of a $4.3 million jury verdict rendered for Illumination International LLC in a dispute involving the delivery of medical gloves. In December 2022, the Indiana Commercial Court in Marion Superior Court entered a judgment awarding Illumination, an importer of medical products, more than $4.3 million in damages in its lawsuit against Vannon Healthcare Global Limited, a company based in the Isle of Man, according to court records. The Court of Appeals of Indiana affirmed in August a trial court's judgment awarding damages to Illumination International that put a down payment in 2020 toward the purchase of 705,300 boxes of nitrile gloves, but never received the full order of gloves. Illumination filed a lawsuit that alleged Vannon failed to deliver the boxes of nitrile medical gloves during the height of the pandemic and failed to return Illumination's $2.8 million down payment. This award came after a jury found in favor of Illumination, finding that Vannon had breached the party's contract. Anthony Dowell of Dowell Commercial Litigation represented Illumination International. Dowell said he and I Yang Rick Lee, Illumination International's president and CEO, were very pleased with the High Court's ruling, but not surprised because it, quote, was a frivolous appeal to begin with, end quote. Quote, Vannon's arguments on appeal were absurd, which is reflected in the appellate court's decision, and the Indiana Supreme Court had no reason to accept transfer of the case. There were no important or conflicting issues of law involved in this case, and we had a jury verdict. Vannon was just delaying the inevitable day of reckoning with these frivolous appeals, end quote, Dowell said in an email to Indiana Lawyer. Dowell said he and Lee are confident that Illumination will be paid. Samuel Nunberg, who serves as general counsel for Vannon, told Indiana Lawyer that the company filed its petition for transfer in good faith with the Indiana Supreme Court. Nunberg said there were legitimate legal issues involved with Vannon's efforts to appeal the verdict. Quote, we thank the Indiana Supreme Court for their consideration and move on from here, Nunberg said, adding, I think it was a close call myself, but it is what it is, end quote. Nunberg said Vannon would not be filing any further appeals of the verdict.
Staying with the High Court, I attended the first night court for legislators a few weeks ago. Chief Justice Loretta Rush invited the Indiana General Assembly to attend an oral argument to see how the laws they create are applied in court. The justices heard arguments in a forfeiture case in which an aunt claimed the money taken during a parole-related search was hers and not her nephew's. In July 2023, the appellate court rejected Angela Smith's argument that the state did not prove a connection between the money and criminal activity. The state argued that Smith did not have standing. Senate President Pro Tempore Roderick Bray R. Martinsville and House Speaker Todd Houston R. Fishers acted as honorary bailiffs. The leaders said that the event was a great opportunity for their members and helped them think more deeply about the language they use when crafting new laws. Next, Daniel, tell us what is going on at the Northern District Court.
A Highland man caught stealing mail is facing more than 2 years in prison after being sentenced in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Indiana. Neuralden Green III was sentenced by Senior Judge John DiGiulio after pleading guilty to theft of mail. Green was sentenced to 2 years and 3 months in prison, followed by 2 years of supervised release. The United States Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Indiana announced Green's sentence. From February 2022 through June 5, 2022, Green, while impersonating a United States Postal Service carrier, stole mail from various receptacles, which included checks made out to victims within the Northern District. A probable cause affidavit stated that, at the time of his apprehension by the DeMotte Police Department, Green was dressed as a postal employee and was in possession of approximately 60 pieces of stolen mail in DeMott. Green had an official Postal Service satchel, which contained mail from various locations, including Effingham, Illinois, Michigan City, DeMott, Valparaiso, and Champaign, Illinois. Postal inspectors spoke with Green, and he acknowledged he was not a U.S. Postal Service employee, but used the uniform to disguise himself while stealing mail from mailboxes.
Alrighty, next, an Indiana Catholic couple has petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to take their case, alleging their child was taken from their home because they would not use the child's preferred pronouns. Attorneys with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, representing parents Mary and Jeremy Cox, filed a reply brief in their case a few weeks ago, expressing their concerns that a similar situation could happen to other parents. In 2019, the Cox's son informed them that he identified as a girl, but because of their religious belief that God creates human beings either male or female, they would not refer to their child using pronouns and a name inconsistent with what was given at birth. In 2021, the Indiana Department of Child Services began investigating the Coxes following two reports that they were suspected of abusing or neglecting their child. DCS alleged AC was a child in need of services due to the neglect and the parents' actions endangering AC's health. According to the petition, AC was suffering from an eating disorder for a year and hadn't been seen by a medical professional. The appellate court affirmed the trial court's order removing AC from the Cox's home in 2022. Meanwhile, AC turned 18 years old and DCS terminated the case. Mary and Jeremy then petitioned the Indiana Supreme Court for transfer, but their petition was denied. Before the U.S. Supreme Court, the state is arguing that the case is moot because AC is now an adult and there is no relief available to the parents. But the Coxes are arguing that their case is an excellent vehicle for addressing the question of when a state can, quote, muzzle parental speech and remove a child from the home of admittedly fit parents, end quote. Now let's head over to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Daniel, there is a new historic appointment to the court, correct?
Yes. President Joe Biden's most recent nominee to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals would be the first Hispanic judge to serve on the Chicago-based appellate court if she is confirmed. Judge Nancy L. Maldonado, currently of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, was nominated to the appellate bench February 21st. Maldonado was nominated to fill the vacancy created by Judge Ilana Rovner's taking senior status. According to the White House, Maldonado is a 1997 graduate of Harvard University and a 2001 graduate of Columbia Law School. Her career has included a clerkship for Judge Ruben Castillo of the Northern District of Illinois and work in private practice as both an associate and partner at Minor, Barnhill, and Galland in Chicago. She was confirmed to the Illinois Northern District Court bench in 2022. Notably, Maldonado has the backing of Senator Dick Durbin, the Illinois Democrat who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, Reuters reported. She also has the support of the state's other senator, Tammy Duckworth.
Staying with the Seventh Circuit, the court heard oral arguments a few weeks ago in a case involving an Indianapolis teacher who is seeking a preliminary injunction against a new Indiana law that prohibits instruction on human sexuality in grades K through 3. Kayla Smiley alleged House Enrolled Act 1608 violates her free speech and is so vague that she does not know what speech and actions may violate the law. The Office of the Attorney General argued that the state sets curriculum requirements that public school teachers must follow. In July, Judge James P. Hanlon of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana issued an order denying the preliminary injunction motion filed by the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana on behalf of Smiley. Smiley filed the appeal with the Seventh Circuit in August to overturn the federal judge's denial of her motion for a preliminary injunction against the Indiana law. And finally, to wrap up this week's headlines, I am working on a story about the attorney shortage in the state for our next print issue. My story is following up on the Indiana Supreme Court's amendments to Rule 13, opening up the bar exam to non-ABA-accredited law school graduates as a way to attract and retain more attorneys in the state. I will be looking into other ways that are being considered to address the shortage. You can read more about it in our March 13th print issue. Okay, that'll do for this week's headlines. As always, if you want more legal news, check us out at theindianalawyer.com. Stick around after our sponsor break to hear my interview with Judge Sarah Evans Barker.
Taft, today's modern law firm. At Taft, we cultivate a highly respectful, transparent workplace that fosters creativity, teamwork, inclusion, and diversity. We couple our culture with a client-first approach, rewarding lawyers who understand their clients' goals and work to deliver success. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
I have with me today in the studio Senior Judge Sarah Evans Barker of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana. Our guest to kick off Women's History Month, Judge Barker was nominated to the federal bench by former President Ronald Reagan in 1984. Following her confirmation by the U.S. Senate, Judge Barker became the first female federal judge in Indiana, making history. She served as Chief Judge from 1994 to 2000. Judge Barker, tell us what life was like for you growing up in Mishawaka.
Well, it was pretty idyllic, I have to say. My parents had chosen to move out into the country about 3 miles south of Mishawaka. And they did it at a time when families didn't usually do that. They stayed closer to schools and closer to their work. We were only 3 miles outside of town, but it gave us a chance to play and have the expanse of country to grow up in. So many of my friends were the kids of farmers. My dad was an electrical engineer, wheel operator, and my mother was a teacher. So when we moved out there, they just bought 6.5 acres on which to grow children and a garden and have animals like horses and rabbits and stuff. So for me, because of my personality and disposition, it was a wonderful place to grow up. I rode the horse every place. I had a tree house. I built more than one raft to go down the creek at the back of our property. And it gave us plenty of space to run and to play. I'm one of 6 kids. I'm the second in the hierarchy. And my grandparents lived with us, so there were 10 of us who lived under that roof. And it was a lively, noisy place. And we all were very busy in school activities. My parents were very attentive to our schoolwork and our development in other ways. We took music lessons and other kinds of lessons. We had part-time jobs. I picked a lot of red raspberries to sell at a store, an IGA in Mishawaka, in order to finance my summer camps. So it was a very happy childhood. It's not to say there weren't some bumps along the way, because when you're growing up, there always are. But I can't think of a single thing that my parents missed the mark on. Whatever didn't turn out was usually my doing, not theirs. So it was a family that was imbued in deep values, a sense of responsibility, not just for our family, but for the larger good. We were very active in our church in Mishawaka, so we participated in all of those activities too. It was a good place to grow up.
So there's this quote from you that has kind of stuck with me over the years about being told, you know, to consider law school. And it's, if she had told me that I should be an astronaut, it wouldn't have been in my mind any more far-fetched. You know, why did you feel this way and do you still?
Well, of course, I don't feel that way anymore. Although nobody's ever suggested I be an astronaut, which is a good thing too. That story, that line came out of my undergraduate years when I was active in student government at IU in Bloomington. And the woman who was a graduate student, who was the faculty advisor for the student government in the dorm where I lived, we worked back and forth pretty closely on things. So we got to know each other well and had a nice friendship. A friendship, by the way, that lasted through all the years. She died about 2 years ago, and she was in her early 90s. I don't think now that she's gone, she'd mind that I said what her age was, but she lived to a ripe old age. But she was very attentive to to me and to the other kids who were working in student government. So we were working along one evening, sort of late on some project, and she said, you ought to go to law school. So that suggestion came entirely out of the blue. I didn't know that women went to law school. I didn't know any women who had gone to law school. There were no women lawyers that I knew, and there were no lawyers, in fact, in my family. So that's what I say. It sort of came out of nowhere. And it was a little embarrassing to me because I thought she had completely overestimated my abilities and my ambition, my capacity, all of those things. So as I said, if she had suggested I become an astronaut, it couldn't have been more startling a suggestion. But it did plant a seed that seemed to feel right. And it happened at a time also in undergraduate school when I had precious little direction. So it was my junior year. I knew that I was going to be able to graduate on time, but I didn't know anything about what would be next. I didn't even choose a major until my junior year because I was just sort of hopscotching around, taking classes that I really enjoyed and appealed to me. I treated IU's curricula offerings like a big smorgasbord, and I just would choose things without any regard to whether it was going to equip me to have a certified bona fide major that would allow me to graduate. So I was trying to get my act together my junior year, and I did. But here comes this suggestion from this friend whom I greatly respected and enjoyed and admired. So I was really too embarrassed to talk to anybody about that. But it set me on a journey to try to figure out if that would be something that would appealed to me, and could I get into law school, and how did I get into law school? So I undertook the explorations to figure that out. I went over to the library and I looked at the descriptions of various law schools' curriculums, and they just started the LSAT test. So I had to sign up to do that. When you sign up for that test, you had to give them three law schools where you wanted the results sent. So then I had to figure that out. Cost a little bit of money, not a lot, but a little bit of money to take the test. So then you have a little money on the line. So you don't want to just fritter it away. You don't want to take it as a wasted opportunity. So some momentum started to gather, and it seemed more and more like a good idea. It really wasn't until my idea was fully formed that I disclosed it to anybody, because I didn't want anybody to discourage me by saying, "Are you kidding?" or "What? What are you thinking?" before I sort of had my own sense of it. So that eventually I told my folks, of course, and my folks were always very positive. They would never have discouraged me from anything that looked like it was the right thing for me or the right direction. They were bemused by it because they didn't know any women lawyers either. And nobody in the family had been lawyers. I guess they thought, because all of us women of that era either went into teaching or nursing, there weren't high-level positions in industry. You could get, as I discovered later after I went to law school, women who had a hard time getting into the law firms could get jobs in government. And I didn't know that when I started out going to law school and making the decisions, but it was really a helpful thing for my friend Arden to have told me that. And I expressed my appreciation over and over, and in fact, as each rung of the ladder that I was climbing professionally, I always invited her. She lived over in St. Louis, and I invited her to come, so she was able to come when I was sworn in as a judge. And we stayed in touch over all the years. That's how I know that, sadly, she's now gone, but it's because we stayed in touch. I always made sure she knew that I was grateful then and now.
So, you know, prior to joining the bench, what work were you doing as an attorney?
Well, right out of law school, I graduated from American University in Washington, which was a great place to go to law school. And I got a job on Capitol Hill, working for Senator Percy I worked for a congressman first for just about 9 months, and then a spot opened up on the legislative staff for Senator Percy, who was from Illinois. Not my home state, but he said that he thought a neighbor's perspective might be helpful. So he hired me. And those were really lively, fun years. And I worked hard. Everybody who works on the Hill works long hours. And there's a wonderful esprit de corps among the staff. And I was single, so we had a lot of social activities as well. So in 72, Senator Percy stood for re-election, and I worked on his campaign. That year, my old high school friend, Ken Barker, and I, we had always stayed in touch because we were from the same group of friends. And he had gone to IU, then he went to Harvard to law school. But we always stayed in touch because we enjoyed each other's company. And he asked me if I would, what I thought about getting married. I thought that was a good idea. So I was actually able to marry one of my best friends, which is a good way to start a marriage. But he was here practicing law at the end of 72. So after the campaign, we went on our honeymoon, and then I came here. The whither thou goest syndrome, I always say. So I needed to use my government contacts to try to find a job here because we were in the throes of the campaign. I was living in Washington, not here. So I had to figure out a way to hunt for a job that was going to be efficient and expeditious. So I was able to, with the help of a couple of friends, learn that there was an opening on the U.S. Attorney's staff here for an assistant. So I applied for that. I came out for an interview, and I was hired to start after we got back from our honeymoon at the end of 72. So when we got back from our honeymoon, Stanley Miller, bless his heart, he was such a wonderful friend and mentor. He was the U.S. attorney. And he said, well, come in so we can get you signed up and get the papers filed and so forth. And we had just gotten back. We went to London for our honeymoon. It was a great honeymoon. And I had all the wedding presents still in boxes. I had rugs rolled up at our new little house. I said, well, really, I wanted to start farther in January. No, no, he says, come on in. So unbeknownst to me, he had planned a press conference for my swearing in. I thought I was just going to fill out papers, you know. I did wear a nice dress, but I had not anticipated that. I wasn't entirely put off by press conferences because I had been familiar with press conferences from Washington. So I wasn't dumbstruck in the face of a microphone and the cameras, but I was surprised. And the thing that made it newsworthy was that I was the first woman lawyer who had been hired in the U.S. Attorney's office. I didn't know that either. So when the cameras rolled and the press reporters were asking me questions, you know, one of the questions was, how does it feel to be the first woman? And I remember saying, I don't know, I never tried this as a man. So I just feels fine. I'm going to work hard and do my best. So being an assistant U.S. attorney turned out to be a job I really enjoyed. And I felt like I did it pretty well. But I was also mindful that I was holding the door for other women. So ask any woman my age, and they'll tell you the same, that you feel the weight of the responsibility not to screw up and not to make it harder for women to follow you by virtue of however you have done your responsibilities. So I worked really hard to be a good assistant U.S. attorney. And then Stanley Miller left, and Jim Young became U.S. attorney, and he made me his first assistant in the office, which is chief of staff. Meanwhile, Ken and I are starting a family because we had waited till we were into our jobs, our professions, before we got married. So we had to get on with it. So by the time I finished up my stint as an assistant U.S. attorney, we had two little babes. And it was a lot to balance. But, you know, you have to marry well under those circumstances and have a husband who's a partner, all in with whatever it takes. So because I was first assistant, I was in a policymaking position in the office. And when the White House changed, the U.S. attorney and the first assistant stepped aside to let the president choose somebody to take your place. So I did that. And that's when I went into private practice at Bose McKinney and Evans. And I was there for 4 years. And then President Reagan was elected. So I am a Reagan appointee twice, the first time as U.S. attorney and then as a judge. But I need to emphasize that it was really Senator Lugar who played the influential role. I didn't have any friendship with President Reagan, but it was Senator Lugar who vouched for me and gave me these wonderful opportunities. So I was in private practice for 4 years. I came back as U.S. attorney for three when I was head of the office. And Judge Holder, was my predecessor, died suddenly. And I was in a position that traditionally represents an easy step from U.S. attorney into a federal district court judgeship because you're doing the same kind of work, just from a different perspective. So that's the pathway. And that was in 1984 that I was sworn in as a judge. So it being 2024, in March, next month, I hit the 40-year point.
That's pretty amazing.
It's been a great journey. And I was the first woman, as you know, appointed to the federal bench. And that I was the first and only woman for a very long time, an unseemly length of time. Now I have wonderful women colleagues. Judge Pratt, our chief judge, and Judge Stinson, and the Northern District just is about to install. I don't think they've sworn in their two new women judges, but there were already two other women up in the Northern District. But for about 20 years, throughout all of Indiana, the Northern and Southern Districts, I was the only woman. So, yes, it was lonely. Do you remember the remarks, the wonderful observations that used to get made by Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg about how important it was to have another woman on the court, and that it was for reasons of collegiality, but it also allowed their voice to be magnified in a way to have another woman hear it because we hear each other differently, and to have it have an increased credibility when another judge on the court says that she agrees with her woman colleague, or she takes that idea and moves it one way or another. So having women colleagues is a huge social benefit, but it's also a substantive benefit in terms of the work you do, because we have different filters, different ears for how we hear each other. And it made it a whole lot more fun. So after I was at Bose McKinney, we had our third baby. So most of the speeches that I was asked to give during those years when I was the only woman on the court and thus in a visible position in the legal community and in the community at large, most of the speeches I was asked to give were to women's groups who wanted to know how to establish a balance between family and work and your civic responsibilities, your professional responsibilities. And there are no secrets. I mean, it's a day-to-day struggle. But you can help each other by being candid about it and sharing your insights. So as I said, most of the speeches I gave, and I gave a lot of speeches. I have over all these years given a lot of speeches. But in those early years when we had young children and my husband practiced law for a while and then he stepped back because he didn't like it as much as I do. And we live an hour south of Indianapolis, which was another complicating factor. So I was happy to spread the word. Mostly I hope I encouraged other people to. And that's what I used to say, trust your instincts. Your instincts and your abilities will carry you farther than you think. You don't let your doubts and concerns hold you back from trying it. So, but you'll find your own road. Everybody does.
You know, if you hadn't chosen to follow the legal career path, what job do you think you would have?
Oh, everybody, you know, I think goes through that process. They fantasize about what else. Sometimes I have confided in my clerks that my ideal other job would be to be a rural postal delivery person. So I could get in my car with my container of coffee, my music, and wander the roads of southern Indiana and poke mail in the mailboxes and look out for somebody who may be old and fragile who hasn't picked up their mail, and I could stop and check and make sure they're all right. So you can see why that idea might appeal to me, because I'm just out and about on my own without any real responsibilities except to get the mail delivered. So that's sort of a joke. If I had another professional direction, I think it might have been journalism. There's a lot of crossover between journalists and lawyers. And I've noticed that over the years, that many of the same skills, journalists are observers. They are watching, they're assessing, they're evaluating. They stay on the circumference, the periphery of whatever the activity is in order to report it and tell what happened. And that's what lawyers do too. Lawyers are helping clients who have issues that have to be resolved, but it's not the lawyer's problems. So, and then the writing skills and the reading and trying to find the right ways to say important ideas. So maybe a journalist. I enjoyed my work on Capitol Hill. If I hadn't gotten married and come back to Indiana, I would have done that longer. I don't know that I would have stayed there all that time. But I like working in government. As I said before, that was the pathway that was open to women. Law graduates, women who graduated first in our class at American University, a brilliant woman lawyer, could only get a job at the Department of Labor. She tried at some law firms, but they didn't even give interviews. So that would have been, I graduated from law school in 1969. So it was very hard. Women had a burden of proof that they were going to fit into the profession and not just be there for 2 years and go off and have babies and leave the law firms high and dry after their investments. But the government paid everybody equally. It was the same work as men had. And it was really interesting work because all the regulatory agencies allowed you to develop an expertise in one of them, one of the many agencies. So my friend, her name was Fran Beck, went to the Department of Labor. And I noticed not too long ago, she had a good life. She was a little older than I was. I think she'd had her children and so forth when she went to law school. But she died, and I saw the little notice in our alumni magazine that she had worked all her professional life at the Department of Labor. So turned out to be a good job for her, when really I think other doors were not open.
So what changes have you seen in the legal profession, you know, generally and specifically for women?
For women? Well, it's a whole new world. I mean, I was on the front of the wave of women coming into the profession. So everything's changed. Now the law schools, most law schools have at least 50% of the students who are women. And the number of graduates is right at that same level. I mean, they see it through. There are still places of disparity and inequity. The corporate boards do not reflect women's participation in the numbers in which they ought to be. But in academia, they're very prominent. We just had none of those visible women who could not only set policy directions and make important decisions, but inspire others and encourage others to use their talents without regard to gender. So that is entirely different. One of the things that's changed for everybody in the legal profession is the onset of computers and technology, the internet. It's sped up the way in which we practice law, all those sort of leisurely patterns of dictating a brief to a secretary who writes it in shorthand, It doesn't happen that way anymore. It's everybody at their own keyboards. The kinds of legal problems have gotten a lot more complicated. And it reflects all the ways in which our society is more complicated with technology and AI, with all the ways in which we have a need to be fair and inclusive of all the subgroups. We never worried too much about subgroups in the past. It was during my early career as a lawyer that the employment rights statutes were enacted, Title VII, age discrimination, the Disabilities Act. All of those have been enacted during my career. So those are huge cases, and they change the way in which people react to each other and interact with each other. And that social dynamic often spins out into legal issues and bigger policy decisions that have to be made. How do we live together as a society? And in our search for the common good, it's much harder to reach a consensus as to what the common good is, never mind how you get there. But just to have it be an idea that impels you in a particular direction is a puzzlement. It's hard to get your head around it. So things have gotten complicated in ways that it seems simpler in the past. The profession itself is much more diverse, not just with more women, but with lawyers of all sorts. The ease with which new populations come into the law, there aren't as many barriers as there used to be, including economic barriers. It used to be what people did who were well-heeled. People who didn't have the opportunity to get a graduate education couldn't have become lawyers. And then we have all the other issues of media saturation and social media that create really interesting legal problems. So it's in these 40 years, it's a whole lot of change. It's some days it's bewildering. And I remember I did spent about 10 years or so, a few years back, immersed in a group that was a group of judges, but they were international judges, federal and state, who were working on problems of genetics in the courts. And it was, genetics were just coming into the sort of scientific knowledge of society. So we had a genetic capacity to test people and to learn things about genetics and to impose standards and so forth. So problems with respect to the science were outpacing the law. The law always sort of lags behind to figure out how do we deal with new science. So at that time, the genetics was new science. So it created problems of contract law and property law and civil rights and constitutional law, patents, trademarks. So across the whole spectrum of law, the arrival of genetic science was changing the templates and the paradigms that we were using to solve the problems. So for example, this is one we used to talk about. Because it was possible to test a people for genetic predispositions, we used to think about what would happen if an airline pilot was forced to undergo a genetic test. Because when the pilot is in the cockpit, he's managing a lot of responsibility, lives, a lot of lives all at once. So would it be fair to require him to have a genetic test to determine if he had a predisposition to alcoholism or depression or narcolepsy or some condition that would give people pause to have him be the pilot? Well, in years past, you never could do that. You wouldn't have the science that would tell you. But now, the science could tell you that. But was it fair? I mean, does a predisposition, a proclivity, necessarily mean it's going to turn out that way? So you can see how the issues all play through. I cite that just as an example of how much change there's been. It's been enormous.
It certainly has, yeah.
I'll just add this. They say about the federal district courts that we're the last bastion of generalists in the law, which means we have to be prepared to solve virtually every kind of problem that crops up. Because we're a synthesizing force in the law, we have to make the fabric of the law hold together, so we weave it. And that's why we still have some courts that handle all kinds of disputes and cases without specialization. So as a judge in a court, of whom that's expected in this rapidly changing world, it's a tall order. We have to work hard to be up to the level of the problems that are put before us for solutions.
Do you think there are changes still to be made?
Oh, yes, you know there are. Today, we could spend the rest of this interview talking about what we can just barely see ahead of us. But even in barely seeing it, we can foresee that there are huge legal issues, constitutional issues, just the issues that have landed in our laps in the last year with respect to women's reproductive rights. The decision out of Alabama yesterday, and a lively Supreme Court docket now that's trying to deal with the aftermath of the Dobbs decision. So in having issued their opinion in the Dobbs case, they solved that case, but they sort of opened Pandora's box because they've left it to all the states now to decide what policies and what issues they want to adopt and formulate. So if you want to predict the future, you would be able to look in almost any direction. I mean, it's a 360 proposition that in every direction you can imagine, there are huge changes. Look at what is happening in education. Up and down the line, from preschool, universal preschool, we haven't gotten that yet, through the universities and graduate education. Look what happened to the three university presidents who testified and wound up within a week afterwards not having jobs. So they're sitting in the bullseye too and trying to finance education and making it fair for everybody to have access to education. And what about legacy enrollments? I just read today that Yale has decided they're going to rely on standardized tests again. So everything's in flux. But it actually makes being a lawyer a wonderful job because you never get bored. There's always something new. And the law gives you an opportunity to test your theories, to sort of see where the boundaries are and how they're shifting. So I've never regretted being a lawyer.
Well, what kind of inspires you? Either, a person or just, anything.
Well, to do this work, you have to sort of find your inspiration every day. And part of it is from the challenges of the work itself. It has to capture your interest. It has to respond to your own natural curiosity about things. One of the good things about the district court, the federal district court, is that you're engaged with other people all the time, with the lawyers who are appearing before you and the jurors and the witnesses, the defendants, and clients, and so forth. Not to mention all the courthouse personnel, the probation officers and the marshals and so forth. So all of those interpersonal relationships are, to me, very inspiring. I draw a lot of pleasure and support and reinforcement from being able to work with really good, really smart people who are also very dedicated. So that's inspiring. That I knew from the beginning when I first got into law school that I liked the company I was able to keep with lawyers. They're funny, they're quick, they love stories, they are fun at teasing, which I've always thought is fun. They're sort of on the cutting edge of things, so they have novel ways of looking at things. You know, there's the usual cadre of difficult personalities, but in a way, that sort of adds to the flavor of the mix. So I'm inspired by by the profession and by the potential that the profession allows lawyers to make a difference. One of the good things about being a lawyer is it extends your reach into the community and into government, into the life of our country. So that inspires me. I do a lot of reading. I have my hour commute, and I listen to a lot of podcasts and materials that you would maybe think are inspiring. They inspire me. My children inspire me, my grandchildren. I have a wonderful husband. He inspires me. He would laugh if he heard me say that, because I doubt if he thinks very much about that day to day, that I find inspiration from him, but I do. So there are a lot of very fine people who are working hard to make life better in the sphere in which they're active. And if you notice that, then you're not only inspired, but you don't lose hope. And you can find the joy that is motivating them just by observing what they're doing. So there's a lot of inspiration around and about. You have to be careful at my senior status years here to keep looking for those things that inspire you, so you don't get bogged down by the amount of change and the pace of change, the loss of friends, because we're at a stage in my life and my husband's life where we're losing friends. And there are reasons that you could shake your head and say things aren't as good as they used to be. But oh, yes, they are. They're as good. They're more challenging. It goes faster than we're comfortable with at my age in lots of ways. But there are reasons to continue to try to live every day, which is what I'm doing, because I've stayed on the court well past my retirement eligibility date, as you know.
Do you have any advice for young women in the legal profession?
Yes, although, you know, I get as much advice. They couch it differently. I mean, they're not quite as bold in telling me what they think I ought to do, except in the context of a case. But I watch them. And in lots of ways, I want to be like them. I want to see how they're living their lives and how they find the balance and see what gives them joy. So, yes, you know, we say about people in my age category, we're in our anecdotage. So we always have stories and advice and more stories to share. Mostly I say to young women a couple of things. One is, you can't have it all. You can't be it all, do it all. Nobody can. So we have to figure out what the priorities are and how you can mix and match and create a life for you that is meaningful. But for you and your spouse, whoever it is you're living with or having a family, to both work fast track, highly demanding jobs that require you to travel and to not observe normal work hours. You can't do that and have a core to your family or to your life or whatever. So you have to figure it out. It's a puzzle. The other thing I usually say to young people is that you have to create a life for the long haul. Most of the young women I'm talking to who still want to be mentored have been very successful in coming through their schooling and their early years of entry into the profession. And they're used to, I always say it this way, they're used to knocking tin cans off the fence posts like it's target practice. And it's ping, ping, ping. And they are very successful at that. They've set goals and they meet their goals. And then they set another goal. And after you get through that time of your life where you're setting goals and meeting your goals, life comes at you in a different way. It doesn't come at you in a series of specific goals. It's a life for the long haul. So you do have to figure out what it is that's going to give you the most meaning and will give you the sources of satisfaction that matter the most to you. But you can't have it all. So don't go into it. I always would tell young women, if you look at me and you think, well, look at Sarah Barker. She's got a job as a judge. She's got three kids. She's got a husband. She lives in the country an hour from here. She's got friends. She does stuff in the profession. So she's done it all. That is not true. That is not true. And we have to make choices. We have to decide which in those various, in that array of choices are the ones that matter the most. And then you build your life around that. You've heard that old sort of metaphor, analogy. I guess you would say it's a visual where you put different size balls in a jar. You've heard of that, haven't you? And that's what you're doing. You know, some balls that you're putting in the jar will be the size of a tennis ball, and some will be the size of an aspirin. And you've got just that jar, and you're going to fill it up. And some things take up more space than other things. So it's that process in very human form. And it's frustrating sometimes because it doesn't always work out easily. It helps to be partnered up with somebody who's verbal so you can talk it all through. And that's what Ken and I did. We had no examples. We had nobody who had done this because Ken pulled back from the practice of law mostly to focus on our kids because we didn't want somebody else to raise our kids. And we didn't see any other patterns for that. So we're having to figure it out as we went. And were there ruffled feathers? Oh, yes. Were there hurt feelings? And were there bumps in the road? Oh, yes. But we were committed to the marriage and to the family, and we were verbal. So we just talked and talked and talked to figure it out. And we had a lot of support from other family members and so forth. But you got to commit first to what it is you're wanting to create to begin with. When you think about the things in your life that you would like to have live on past your days, past your active engagement, there are only a few. But it behooves you to try to think about what they are, why you still got a chance to influence that direction.
All right. That'll do for this week's interview, Judge Barker. Thank you again for joining us. To our listeners, head over to theindianalawyer.com to hear our past interviews. You can also find us on your favorite podcast apps. We'll talk to you soon.